This is Naked Oceans with Helen Scales and me, Sarah Castor-Perry. Now, when we want to study our changing climate and how things might change in the future, we need to look at what has happened in the past. Now, there are several methods that researchers use, from ice cores to tree rings, but what if we want to look at more recent changes from the last couple of hundred years or so? Most of the methods aren't accurate enough for recent history, and some of the most recent data, like the Keeling curve measuring CO2 levels, don't go back far enough. Well, now we have data from an unlikely source, the logs of whaling ships that used to set out to the Arctic waters in the 18th and 19th centuries. Dinah Malloy-Thompson is from the Scott Polar Research Institute here in Cambridge, and I caught up with her to find out more about these whaling logs. But to start off with, why were these ships going out to catch whales in the first place? Dinah explains.
Well, if you think about it, there wasn't much in the way of oil. Lighting was by tallow, which is the fat of animals. And they discovered, many centuries ago, that oil from whales could be extremely valuable in all sorts of commodities, making pharmaceuticals, making butter, margarines, if you like. And, of course, whaling began to provide Britain particularly with the raw materials for a whole industry that was building within the Industrial Revolution. These extraordinary brave men, they went up to the Arctic, you know, in clothing that we wouldn't even go for a Sunday walk in these days. No oilskins. And they braved their way up there, perhaps sometime starting in March, and wouldn't come back till August. And they were extraordinarily good sailors, much to the interest now, because people didn't understand that these people were such good sailors. They had to be to get there and back, to navigate the way there and back, and highly disciplined. So it was a completely different way of sea life.
I suppose now, if we considered people who go out whaling, it's kind of very much from an environmental point of view and from a conservation and animal lover point of view, the people that go out whaling are quite sort of looked down upon and frowned upon. But back then, was it kind of, they were really well respected, they were excellent seamen, they were going out, they were so brave to be going out in these dangerous conditions. And so was it something that was seen as a very brave, impressive thing to go and do?
It was indeed. Within their local communities, in the community, say, of Whitby or Hull, the whole community would be involved in this. In fact, a boat would be owned maybe by 40, 50 people, which would provide the pensions for the widows. And the whalers and their children and their families were part of the major part of the community then. It could be a completely different attitude to animals now than we had then, of course. According to one of the great whalers of the time, Mr. William Scoresby, who became a clergyman in the end of the days and was a very religious man, he viewed the whales as being put there by God for the good of man. Not to be cruel to, but to be used for man. So a completely different attitude. And, of course, the abundance of them was amazing. And they didn't understand that what they were doing would diminish the population to below a critical mass where they couldn't recreate again. So nowadays, of course, there's a different attitude altogether. We don't have any need for whales apart from the pleasure of eating their flesh, which I must say is absolutely delightful. It's wonderful. It's like veal, but it's not what we do nowadays. So of course, it's frowned upon.
Yeah, I mean, it is really interesting that we do have a very different attitude towards whales than we do to anything else that lives in the oceans. You know, the fact that we had this moratorium introduced recently, that we're a long way off doing something like that for even really endangered species like bluefin tuna. And actually, I think apparently back in the 80s, it was around the time we were discovering that whales have these amazing songs and they're very intelligent. I think that brought us much closer to whales. So I think we do have this pretty bad notion of someone who goes out and hunts whales has to be a bad person, which, you know, I think it's just the same as anything else that lives in the sea, really, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Dinah's point about how the whalers were, you know, a real central part of the community. You know, these ships were owned by several families. It was a really important part of life back then. I think things have really changed. Obviously, that's not the view we have of people now. But how do we move from thinking about whalers and whaling and why they were going out to how on earth these logs that they were taking give us information about climate?
Well, in their log, they wrote not just about the whales that they caught and who caught them and how they caught them and so forth. They also, of course, recorded their wind directions and the wind strengths. But they would also record the weather conditions, and they would, so we'd know roughly where they were. We did little matter of longitude, of course, which is a problem, but their latitude was good. So we had a good idea roughly from their log as to where they were and how much ice was about them and what kind of ice was about them. Because they would describe it. They would say that there's streams of ice, thick ice, can't get through ice flows, whatever it was they would describe. And if you're looking at that over a period of, in fact, about 100 years, you can begin to map it roughly. And roughly is sufficient if you're looking at climate rather than weather.
So why did they take such detailed logs?
First of all, the wind directions and wind speed were absolutely vital. It would be important for them because then they would know roughly what was happening to the weather conditions and what to expect, say, further north, east or wherever it was, and which way they could go, whether they could go up to a bay that they knew from the previous year that they got whales in or whether they couldn't go because it was square rigged. So their manoeuvrability was limited. They couldn't get as close to the wind or anything like that. So they needed to know what the wind was doing. And as far as ice was concerned, they would put that down because they could see if there was a stream of ice coming down from the north. They could interpret enough as to what might be happening up further north of them, for example. Perhaps what was more important at the time, not so much about the content, but the fact that they actually had to do it or did it, the government devised a scheme of what they call bounty in order to encourage the whaling industry. And the whaling industry became very important, as I say, the commodities were important to industry. So they had to encourage it. And to encourage it, they offered so many, for example, at the height of it, it was 40 shillings per tonne at the tonnage of a boat. A boat might be anything from 300 to 500 tonnes. And the idea was that that bounty would help to reinforce the hull so they could get through the ice. But when they came back to their home base, they had to show their log in order to receive their bounty. Now, it wasn't based on the number of fish that they caught. It was simply based on the fact that they had a log that conformed to what was required.
So much like the farming subsidies we have today, the government actually supported the whaling industry. But if the whalers had to fill in their logs to get that bounty, you'd perhaps think that they may not be the most accurate guide to climate if they're just filling them in order to collect the bounty. So how do researchers like Dinah make sure the log accounts of wind and ice and weather are accurate?
Of course, you can never be sure of anything like that, but that is the most authentic information that you're going to have. Now, there is a thing that you can do, and that's to validate the information, which, in fact, is what I was actually interested in doing. And if you get two boats together, roughly in the same area, that see each other, so there'll be something in the log that said, saw resolution from Whitby today. If you've got the resolution log, you can go there, and it may say, saw bounty from Hull today. Then you know the two boats have seen each other. So then you begin to compare what they have written in their logs. And if they're completely different, you begin to get, I wonder. But in fact, they turn out to be sufficiently similar to say, yes, they are all doing the same thing. And also the terms that they used, when you convert the terms into, say, a numeric value, you find that they are all saying, using the same terms when they see the same state of water, same state of wind. So, in fact, I've finished my thesis on this very issue about validating the data so that we can know what they say is sufficiently good to use for solid data.
And actually, some even cooler cross-referencing that Dinah managed to do involved the readings in the logs about the state of the sky. In order to figure out where they were, the whalers would take sextant readings using the sun. But if they couldn't see the sun, they'd write something in the log like sun obscured. And Dinah found there was actually a dip around 1816 where a lot of records contained the words sun obscured or sun obscure. So she went off to her history books and found that they coincided with the year without a summer, which was what 1816 was known as because it was caused by the 1815 eruption of the Tambora volcano, spewing these huge amounts of ash into the air and affecting world climate. So the records are actually pretty accurate.
Okay, so how do we use these records once they've been found?
My role, really, I'm not a meteorologist, but my role really is to give back to the meteorologists and the climatologists, really, data that they can then use and that they can extrapolate backwards or forwards in their climate models, to which will begin to show us the movement of weather systems, things like the North Atlantic Oscillation, which is quite important to us, which we think oscillates every 12 years. But we haven't got much data on that. But this will certainly bring an awful lot more data on the periodicity of that. And I say that's what I'm trying to do, is to prepare data which is understandable in its error, its validity is understood. And there's a lot more to be done. We've a lot more data to be found. We've just set up a new project which is being funded by Leverhulme, which is called ArcDoc, and we're going to try to find as many logs as possible, particularly in the Arctic. And I'm hoping to, you know, extend the research so that we can not just get British whaling logs, but there's Norwegians, there's Dutch, there's Danish, there's of course a lot of American ones, get the images of them and digitise them, and extract the data so that we will have a very large database of information available to the mathematicians. These are terribly important when we are looking at our climate, because all our climate ideas are extrapolated from earlier records. And white ice cores are interesting. They don't give us the immediate information that we want, immediate information for the last few 100 years. So certainly the research will certainly last my lifetime and more.
So definitely more work to be done, but I think it's really interesting that we can get some quite unexpected information from something like whaling, and also more of an insight into the lives of the men doing it too. That was Dinah Malloy-Thompson telling us about how she's been uncovering a treasure trove of information about the climate hidden away in the whaling logs from hundreds of years ago. And if you want to carry on with the whale theme this month, check out my latest Naked Science scrapbook video, which is all about why whales don't get the bends when divers can. Although I'll let you in on a little secret, sometimes they actually do, and it's actually because of human intervention. That's all at thenakedscientist.com/scrapbook.